Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to Press One for Democracy. This is Dan Aronson, returned from Down Under. So, G'day mate, how you going? I apologize for any nonsensical comments made in this show. Here's my little disclaimer. I apologize for any nonsensical comments I may make in this show, just because I'm jet lagged. I landed Sunday at yesterday at 10:58 a.m., which is very odd in Portland, Oregon, which is very odd because my journey actually started at 10:45. Enough intro music. There we go. My journey actually started at 10:45 a.m. in Sydney, Australia. I flew to LAX. I boarded another connection, and I got to Portland, Oregon at 10:58 a.m. Sunday morning. So my net trip from Australia to Portland, Oregon was 14 minutes. I'm still not exactly sure how that works, but I also know that when I left here, I left Portland on Friday afternoon, and I didn't get to Sydney until Sunday morning at 6:15 a.m. So I lost my Saturday. So I guess you get it coming back. I regained it. I guess if you move over there and never come back, then you've just lost your day forever and ever. But anyway, time travel, go figure. Again, this is Dan Aronson returning to Press One for Democracy. I think we have an interesting topic for you tonight. And it really comes in the wake of the Trayvon Martin murder trial, George Zimmerman went on trial, and throughout the whole proceedings, there were a lot of typical things that were going on, right? So there were the typical people coming out, and there was first the trial before it ever even sees inside of a courtroom, before there's an arraignment, before, you know, shoot, they even decided whether they're going to press charges or not. Of course, the thing's already played out in the media, right? And we saw a lot of it on our Facebook pages. We saw a lot of it on bloggers talking about it, the injustice and this, that. I mean, George Zimmerman, in many people's eyes, was guilty before he ever even was charged of this crime. On the other hand, we saw some really silly things like the coffee party's involvement, not that we chose to be, but we had one of the jurors who actually had was called to task by the judge, not the jurors, but the potential jurors during the voir dire process when they were impaneling the jury, was called into question when they, one of the basic questions, if you've ever actually been on a jury or been a potential juror, one of the questions they'll always ask you straight out is, well, do you have any predisposition as to how you might rule in the case, right? Of course, they want to know that, you know, if you feel one way or the other. It's a natural question, and everybody says no. People that say yes, by the way, get in trouble, so don't do that thinking you're just trying to get out of jury duty. That usually doesn't work. But one of the jurors was then asked if he had posted a comment on a Facebook page called Coffee Party Progressives, which I'm understanding, or I've been led to understand, that's not our organization. They're not really affiliated, although we have a group of people that call themselves that. And he actually said that he thought George Zimmerman should be given a medal and sent on his way. So, again, you know, prior to the trial, prior to one shred of evidence being presented, the media, you know, is happy to set the stage and allow people to air their opinions and, you know, say what a great tragedy it is and how this guy Zimmerman should be, you know, put on the, he should get the chair, and then other people say he should get a medal. And, you know, that's just how it works, right? And now, of course, it's amplified times a million thanks to social media, right? So now everybody gets to have their say about what they think happened. And the fact of the matter is that there's only one person alive today that really knows what happened that day, and that was George Zimmerman. So do we know the truth? Did the truth come out at the trial? Not going to make comment. Don't know. It's not actually, and I'm going to get a lot of heat for this. That's fine. If you want to call in and disagree with me, that's fine as well. But know this, I was raised by a criminal defense attorney, and when I asked my father, like many criminal defense attorneys get asked, you know, how do you justify your, you know, what you do, you let guilty people go free, he then painstakingly explained to me that when you represent a person who's been accused of a crime, you're not only representing that person, you're representing the rights of every American and their right to due process, a fair trial, confront their accusers, and all of the things that are guaranteed to us in the Constitution, and that is a higher calling and a more important calling than actually necessarily, and I know this is going to sound harsh, than in getting to the truth, right? The court system is not about getting to the truth, and a lot of people don't understand that. It's about your protecting your rights as a citizen to unjust prosecution and to your rights to due process. That's a hard thing for people to understand, and especially when some, you know, when you're involved in a case like this where it's very highly charged, it's very, you know, it's we have the racial play, obviously the racial angle, which has been played out as well. It's, so it's very highly emotionally charged, and it's kind of hard to understand that, but that's the case. And so I really don't want to say was justice served, wasn't it served. I don't know. What I know is the system worked well. The system worked as it's supposed to work, which is evidence was presented on both sides. Lawyers fought hard for their sides, and a verdict was rendered. Whether you agree with the verdict or not is irrelevant. The system worked as it's supposed to work. So that's all I want to comment on. I'm not going to comment on whether I thought George Zimmerman was guilty or not, because, again, that's not important. What is important to me, and what I want to talk about, is the fact that in doing this, everybody and their mother weighed in on something that ended up actually being irrelevant to this particular case, and everybody wanted to make comment on the Stand Your Ground law. Now, we have a separation of powers in this country, right? We have the three legislative, or the three branches of the government. But we also have a separation of powers from states and the federal government, okay? And later on, I can pull out the Thomas Jefferson quote because I love it. But Jefferson basically said, he called the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, which says basically all powers not guaranteed to the federal government here in this Constitution are guaranteed to the states. So it's like everything that's not covered here, each state gets to decide individually. And Jefferson said this was our protection against a fascist state, against a central government that becomes so powerful that the rights of individuals are quashed, right? Now, a lot of people took me to task on that in the Facebook page today. They talked about, oh, states' rights is just about slavery. It was about getting rid of slavery. States' rights is about – but that's not true. It's not true at all. And my comment on that was very simple, and that is – well, I don't think when Jefferson called it the cornerstone and talked about the actual act of stopping government from being too far-reaching and too powerful, I don't think that's what he was talking about. What I think because obviously he was a slave owner, so I don't think protecting minority interests was really at the heart of what Jefferson was thinking when he called it the cornerstone. What he was thinking is, how do we stop the government, and you know, from enacting laws that limit our civil liberties, like we've talked about on the show a million times, like NDAA, like the Patriot Act, like FISA, all of those kinds of things, right? Like their ability to throw you in Gitmo without trial and hold you there forever without trial and suspend your rights. That's the kind of stuff Jefferson was saying we don't want. And remember, the founders were people who lived under these types of rules, right? Rulers, these monarchies, these absolute power governments who, when the king waves his hand and says, hey, this is, you know, law, then hey, this is law. And it, as unjust as it could be, there's no trial, there's no right to due process, there's nothing. They came from these backgrounds and these governments, and they fled from them for that exact reason, for, in seeking civil liberties. And that's what the 10th Amendment was about. You know, did it come into play for civil rights and slavery and all that whatnot? Sure, of course it did. You know, but here's a process. And that's really what I want to talk about tonight, is this process. There is a process. The founders were smart enough to know that times change and circumstances change, and therefore they had to write a document that had the ability to be changed when needed. So, of course, they wrote into the Constitution the amendment process. And that amendment process is very specific. It says you need 3/4 of the states to agree before something becomes the law of the entire land, the entire United States. So let me take a breath. Because I'm really pumped and adrenalized about this, but let me take a breath to say you're listening to Press One for Democracy, and that if you would like to join in on the conversation, and as I always mention, nobody wants to hear me talk for just, you know, an hour or so. We need you guys. So the number to call in is 646-929-2495. Again, that's 646-929-2495. Feel free to call in, and when you do get into the queue, the nice lady there with the British accent, I thought maybe that's a little bit of irony, will tell you to press 1, and that will put you into, your little hand goes up on the board, and then I will know that you want to jump into the conversation. So you know, please do call in, and again, when you do get into the queue, if you want to jump into the conversation, just press 1 for democracy. So we have this system, right, of government in place, or the system of the ability to amend the Constitution. And every once in a while in our lifetime, of course, we've seen successful amendments to the Constitution. We've seen not so successful amendments. The equal rights, that was really based on, you know, wanting to have equal rights for women and men, and but it really was regardless of sex or creed or nationality or other things, right? That didn't pass. And I think a lot of people think it didn't pass because they said it was unnecessary because we already had those protections under the other civil rights amendments. One of my favorites was the prohibition, right? So at one point, and you know, it's so funny because and I got into it with some people on the organizers page today about progressives and the fact that progressives, I believe, have been, you know, are wrongly associated always with liberals and with the left and with lefts. And I don't think that's correct. Obviously, prohibition was a big win for progressives on the right. So if you look at progressive by definition, and I don't mean to go off on a tangent here, but I think it's fun. And I don't see anybody's hands up, so I'm just going to keep talking until somebody raises their hand. But progressives are people that believe in using the government, the power of the government, to force people to do something, right? And once they decided they wanted to do that, of course, they passed, somebody will correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure it's the 17th Amendment, which allowed the government to collect an income tax, which allowed them there to fund the progressive initiatives. Now, some of the progressive initiatives are responsible, many of them are responsible for the greatest advancements in our country and our rise to an economic and militaristic superpower, right? So, the power grid, the national highway system, by the way, that was done by Eisenhower, who was a Republican. So, again, not necessarily a left-right issue, but what it is what progressive is, the opposite of progressive is not conservative. The opposite of progressive is actually libertarian. And we can get into the transpartisan matrix. That's a whole nother fun discussion. But the transpartisan matrix becomes a much better way to lay these things out because it doesn't have just left and right or liberal or conservative. It also has order and freedom. It has a second axis. When you add that second axis in, it becomes a much more accurate way of Dan, my hand is up. Okay, Greg. Greg wants me to stop talking. I don't blame him. I guess I'm running on pure adrenaline at this point. But, Greg, let me open up your mic. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well, Dan. Yeah, you're on a roll, man. That's great. Welcome back to the Western Hemisphere.
Thank you. And Northern. That was a completely flip flop.
It went from corner to corner.
Yes. And oh, by the way, I want to tell people, just in case you've always wondered this, and another question that I always get asked is, does the water really swirl the opposite way in the toilet? The problem is that they're all European-style toilets, which means it comes just in a gush from the front to the back, so it doesn't swirl. So I can't tell you.
The mystery remains.
I looked and looked and looked for an American-style toilet, and I couldn't find one. So it's still a mystery. I don't know if it swirls the opposite way.
It's hilarious.
But
that was the only reason I called. I wanted to find out about the toilet swirl. So.
Okay. Well, there you go.
It's
just weird thinking backwards, right? I was in Sydney, which is actually north of Melbourne, and I'm looking at the weather patterns, and I'm trying to figure out why it's colder all the time in Melbourne than it is in Sydney. And then I realized, no, dummy, in our hemisphere, when you go south, it gets warmer. In their hemisphere, when you go north, it gets warmer. It's just really strange. But that's a wonderful place. I mean, if you ever get to go, because Australia is amazing.
But, Sounds great. Welcome
so we got
back.
The swirling and the weather patterns and the backwards thinking out. What is it you're really called about?
Actually, I thought I would toss you a little softball, perhaps, and ask you to maybe comment on the question I'd asked you on the Facebook page, and that was that I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on the people that you believe are maybe pushing their brand of morality and wanting to bypass the process that is in place if the federal government is going to somehow amend the Constitution and require states to do something that they don't want to do, to the point you were making earlier and the examples that you cited. Where do you think that's coming from?
Well, I think it obviously it comes from the extremes, right? It comes from people who have a mindset, and again, these sit on both sides of the legacy, what I call the legacy scale, the left and right, the liberal versus conservative. They're just people who know better. You know, I know better for you. So on the right, it's almost always, to me, my observation, just strictly my observation, it comes from the religious sect. It's from people who want to legislate morality. You know, so there's, you know, they want specific laws to be put in place to govern people's behavior.
I agree with that observation. Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, they're going to use the power of the federal government to do it. Now, the founders said, okay, well, we're going to kind of nip this one in the bud, right, with the separation of church and state, which I believe is a very misinterpreted clause of the Constitution myself. Because a lot of people say, well, you can't just say separation of church and state, because it says that the government shall make no specific religion or shall not force you to participate or practice in a specific religion.
Right.
It doesn't say that the government should be devoid of all religion, should have nothing to do with religion. It doesn't mean that you can't say that, you know, the words, I pledge allegiance to, you know, one nation under God. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say that you have the right to strike the national or the Pledge of Allegiance from school because that's forcing. I think it's some of the ridiculous stuff. But regardless, I think that's where it comes from. On the left, what it comes from is people with, an overdeveloped sense of generosity. There are people that say, I believe that we should give and give till it hurts, and I'm going to use the government to make you do the same thing. And I think the easiest group of people to target there are what are known as the limousine liberals. You know, people in Hollywood that, you know, these movie stars that make tens of millions of dollars for, you know, 30 days worth of work. And they're like, look, I'm just going to give and give and give and give. And I think we should elect people that make everybody do the same thing, even though they're maybe unemployed for a year or working in a low-wage job because that's all the work they can find. So that's where I see those people coming from on either sides.
Okay, so I see. Yeah, absolutely. I see exactly the same sort of thing. My question maybe was a little bit more specific, and it was related to this idea of some states that have stand your ground laws, some states that have different degrees of concealed carry laws. In a modern age, in a modern society, that to me doesn't seem very, first of all, doesn't seem very civil, and secondly, seems awfully difficult for citizens to kind of keep track of as they go from state to state. I don't think the founding fathers were necessarily all that prescient and couldn't, and they never could have foreseen what society would be like, you know, 260 years on. So I think one of the things that I tend to support is the idea that we should be willing to change the way that the states and the federal governments operate relative to each other. I don't think it's too big of a stretch to imagine that, you know, somebody who moves from one state to the next, and I don't mean move as in pick up domicile and move. I mean, you move from one state to the next and you get in trouble because you don't know what the concealed carry laws are in the state you're going to. And I know you can make the argument that it's your responsibility and you should be responsible for it. It just seems like, I don't know, I guess in this particular case, and I'm not suggesting anything other than the idea of a constitutional amendment. I was curious to know when it came to, you know, changing of the gun laws. I mean, I would characterize myself as one of those people who is adamantly against what I understand to be Florida's version of the Stand Your Ground law. And regardless of whether it was part of George Zimmerman's defense or not, it is precisely at the core of what happened there. I don't think there's ever going to be any way I could be convinced otherwise. And so I'm one of those people who thinks that a law like Stand Your Ground, it ought not to be a state decision, because we live in one country now. We don't live in, you know, we are the United States of America, and something like the opportunity for an average citizen to kill another citizen is not something that is trivial enough to be left to the states. I don't mean to say trivial, because it's not a trivial matter, but I can't think of a better word to, in a relative sense, I don't think that's something that ought to be left to the states.
So let me see if I can go back then from because there were a couple of things I noted in your conversation, and I wanted to make sure I covered them all. Well, first of all, I agree with you wholly about the founding fathers not being able to ever imagine the mobile society we have today. Obviously, you know, we were majority of when everybody came over here at first, it was all agrarian, right? I mean, the Industrial Revolution hadn't really kicked in. There were no really, you know, there were major cities, but, you know, the idea of somebody picking up and moving, it wasn't that big of a deal. I totally agree with you there. What I'm going to say is this. You talk about, you know, and with all due respect, and you know, you know, I love you, Greg, but with all due respect, you just did what I kind of don't like about what politicians do that want to divide us. You went right to the most divisive possible issue, right? So what I want to do is I want to ping a few more different issues off of you and get your reaction to them, and let's see if we can't kind of figure this out, maybe talking about something that's less emotional, right?
Sure.
Where I live in Portland, Oregon. If you're a geography buff, then you know that Portland is right on, the only thing that separates Portland from Washington State is the Columbia River.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just over the river is a little sleepy town, or was a little sleepy town, called Vancouver, Washington. Vancouver, Washington has now ballooned to 140,000 people for this particular reason and this alone. In Oregon, there is no sales tax, but there's very high state income tax, the top 10% at the top bracket. In Washington state, there is sales tax, but there's no personal income tax.
Mm-hmm.
So guess what people started doing from Oregon, from Portland, who didn't really feel like paying any tax. They moved to Vancouver and escaped both. Is that okay?
Right. Yeah.
Is that okay?
Is that okay?
Should states be allowed to regulate their own taxes?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't think I have a big objection to that idea. I live in a state where I get taxed pretty well. I guess we're somewhere in between because we have a sales tax and an income tax. When I lived in New York, lots of people lived in Connecticut and worked in the city because there was no income tax if you were domiciled in Connecticut. So. Yeah,
So we should have the same gun laws, but we should be allowed to have different taxation laws.
And here's why. States,
okay, I'm listening.
States will okay. Well, so, since you postulated the idea, I think in the case of state tax revenues and expenditures, there's a more localized environment in which those decisions are going to get made that will affect only the citizens of that state, right? So if the state of Oregon wants to have a high income tax so that they can provide government services that require that kind of funding, well, then you make a conscious decision to live there and you accept the notion that you may have services that the people in Washington don't have. There's not too much you could do to avoid this close interaction between the people living across the river and Oregon who feel like maybe in your mind might be, you know, getting a double advantage, you know, unless you create some pretty wide DMZs and make commuting that's kind of a silly suggestion, of course, but the point is, in this case, you're never going to get harmed physically. Your life will never be in jeopardy by those people who live in Vancouver, Washington, avoiding the Portland state income tax.
Unless, as Biz Tutor in the chat room joked, and I agreed, unless I'm going to shoot my gun across state lines. Okay, but that's the point. So this is exactly what I call this. So I call this, you know, you say we're a nation, one nation. I disagree totally. We're a nation of tribes. We're tribal.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting word I saw that you used today too. And I would tend to disagree with you. I would like to believe. I don't tend to. I absolutely disagree with you in this case. The notion of tribes and tribalism, I think, on some level, is at the root of a lot of our discord in the United States and even around the world.
Absolutely. I mean, look at the Native Americans. A lot of them warred against tribe totally all the time. And throughout history, we've warred tribe against tribe. But that doesn't mean we're not tribal. And that doesn't mean that we can all live under the same tribal law.
Yeah, and you know, there's lots of manifestations of tribalism that are centered around things like religious beliefs, cultures and customs, and on some level, imaginary legislative lines of jurisdiction. This is something that's inbred in us from, you know, I think from an absolutely prehistoric genetic level, is that the only way you survived was with the support of your tribe, and another tribe represented a threat, in a real sense. And we need to, as a thinking species, continue to think that out of our values, out of our morals, out of our legislation. And so bringing this back to gun laws, I don't believe that America and its citizens are any safer if more of them are armed and have more freedom and opportunity to use those arms. I'm glad when I see trends that the number of households with guns is actually going down. it scares me to think that with the gun sales rising, that means there's even more armament being accumulated by a smaller segment of the population. And if I, you know, kind of play this out in a you know, twisted sort of horror show kind of way, you know, fewer people with lots more guns and laws that allow for one person, the survivor, to tell the story as to what happened, and no one else can dispute it. Michael Charney shared a database from, I think it was Tampa Bay Sun or whatever the newspaper is called there, and I perused through it over the weekend. I couldn't find like, you know, the home intruder being shot as he was breaking into the house. I couldn't find the woman who was being accosted in the parking lot killing somebody because she had a gun in her purse. These were people that were getting in fights outside of strip clubs. These were people that were getting killing each other over drug deals gone bad because one of them was selling fake drugs. I mean, is that real? And Stand Your Ground was probably never meant for any of that, but that's what it is. And so, again, I would suggest that, in my own humble opinion, it's a law that is a terrible law. It cannot be adjudicated well. It cannot be enforced very well. And I think, as a nation, I'm one of those people that is kind of raising my hand and saying, whatever we need to do to overturn those laws, I'm behind it. I'm going to get behind that effort, whatever that is.
I'm not a constitutional lawyer. Because you feel you have a right to visit Florida and you have a right to feel safe in Florida just like you do in your home state that doesn't have that.
Oh, I live in a state that has what's called the Castle Doctrine. So it's almost as bad here.
Oh, well, I will tell you this. My father has defended on more than one occasion people who have had people break into their homes and who used lethal force as is prescribed by the law if a person breaks in your home in Illinois, at least the last time I had this discussion with my father, if they break into your home with the intent to commit a felony, you may shoot them dead. And yes, of course, obviously, once you shoot them dead, who's to say? Who's going to argue?
Right.
But let me tell you something. These people don't go to jail. They rarely go to trial. They rarely get charged. So, you know, but now we're onto a different argument, and that's the argument of safety versus, you know, my right to feel safe in my home or anywhere I go versus your right to feel safe because you just don't want people carrying guns. And that's a different subject. But the thing is that it sounds to me like you're saying, well, we have another caller. We have lots of people on call in the hole, but we only have one that just raised their hand. So I'm going to bring you in 305 right here in a second. But it sounds like you kind of agree that there are certain things that should be tribal in nature, right? But there are certain – I mean, should nothing be left of the tribe? Should we just have no local – no city, no state, no – No. I mean, it's like now you're talking about the ultimate slippery slope. How do I choose what is and what should be regulated on a nationwide basis and what shouldn't? Right. And
that's
a
difficult question.
And that's
yes.
That's the very slippery slope. But thank you for getting the ball rolling. I'm gonna leave your mic open just for fun.
Yep.
What?
I said yeah. Yeah. Thanks. Thank you.
Okay, and we're going to bring 305, and then 641, we're going to come right to you. 305, is this Neil from Fort Lauderdale?
No, this is One Angry Jew from somewhere.
One Angry Jew from somewhere. Hey, AG, what's going on, man? Or AJ?
Did I just hear you say that in the Castle Doctrine in your home, somebody comes in to commit a felony, you can shoot them dead?
The last time, I'm not a lawyer. Do not take this as legal advice, but my father has defended multiple people, and in Illinois, when he did it, at the time we discussed this, it was my understanding that if somebody breaks into your house with the intent to commit a felony, you have the right to defend yourself with lethal force. That was the law as I understood it, not a lawyer, in Illinois.
Well, I understand that, but that's a big difference between shooting them dead. I have had lethal force training. I've had legal training as well as tactical. I carry a firearm. And if I'm attacked, I will use it. to defend myself. But in no way, shape, or form would I ever use my gun to kill somebody. I would never shoot somebody in my house with the intent to kill them. You letting that sink in? I would shoot them.
I'm hearing you, in order to make them stop.
I would make them stop whatever aggression they are exhibiting. When the aggression stops, I stop.
I hear you. And that's a wonderful utopian world that actually supports the NRA's concept of, hey, it's not what we need to stop guns from getting into people's hands. We just need to train them properly. If everybody had the skill to shoot somebody to stop them, then that would be a beautiful world, wouldn't it?
That's not utopia. No, it's not utopia. I don't know why you say it that way.
It's Do you think that anybody that has a gun automatically has the skill to shoot somebody in the leg and stop them from doing
it versus shooting them in the heart or the head?
No,
absolutely not. I would not shoot somebody in the leg. I would shoot them in one of two places. If it's a man, I'm likely going to shoot them in the groin or the chest, whichever is the biggest.
Mind me not to break into your house.
Well, I'll give you an example. If somebody comes at me with a knife, the best place to shoot them is in the pelvis, because if you break their pelvis, they're not moving towards you any further. If they have a gun, you want to shoot them in the center of mass, which would be the center of the chest. But a lot of these guys have bulletproof vests. So nobody goes to shoot for leg because you're going to miss it. Nobody, and when you're in a situation like that with adrenaline pumping, it's not easy to aim. So you aim for the center of mass. That's what's taught at the police academies. That's what's taught in the self-defense courses. However, you are never taught, and you never say that you're going to shoot them dead. Because here's what's going to happen. I don't know if you have a gun in your house. But one day, if you ever have to use that gun in self-defense, somebody's going to pull the archive of this show with you saying you have the right to shoot them dead. And they're going to play that to a courtroom, to a jury. And they're going to make you out to be somebody that you're not because you said it that way.
Yep.
That makes sense?
No,
now,
your father
is a lawyer. You should understand that. That makes perfect sense. But my intent's not to kill somebody who's coming aggressively towards me. It's not personal. It's not personal that they're trying to do whatever they're trying to do. And my getting them to stop doing what they're doing is not personal either. I was surprised that the first thing that Zimmerman didn't do, and I assume you're talking about Zimmerman, but I was surprised that the first thing Zimmerman didn't do was get on that mobile phone of his and call 911 and get an ambulance there to help Trayvon Martin. Okay? I don't care if he shot him. He should have immediately, after he did shoot them, after the attack was stopped, he should have immediately called 911 for an ambulance. And I'm surprised nobody brought that up.
Yeah, I've never heard that either.
He was having some conversation with somebody, and he told somebody, the police are on their way. Well, the police are not on their way knowing that there had been a shooting, and I don't believe the police were on their way knowing that somebody had been shot. So not only should the police have been on their way, but paramedics should have been on their way. And I think that precious moments were lost just for the fact that Zimmerman never called 911. And I can tell you that because I took the self-defense course 30 years ago. But I remember clearly in there that that's what you do.
Let me ask you this.
Because your intent is not to kill them, is it?
All right. So let me ask you this. Because we're actually not talking about the specifics of the case. What we're talking about is at what point do we as a society, as a nation, decide that something should be not a matter of the state, not a matter of states to decide, but a matter of the nation of the nation as a whole to decide. So let's talk about it.
Nothing should be as a matter of the nation to decide. It should be left to the states. That's why we have a 10th Amendment.
So you and I are on the same side. Greg seems to think in matters that are critical, crucial, that could cost me my life, like gun laws, that there should be a standard across the nation.
Why should? No, absolutely not.
So I don't want to talk for Greg. Go ahead, Greg.
It should be, should be determined by the people that live in the state. Look, we don't live in a kingdom. We live in a republic. A lot, some people like to call it a democratic republic, but the definition of democracy is five wolves and one sheep deciding what's for dinner. That's a democracy. I want to live in a republic. And
you forgot about the sheep being well armed. That's my boy Franklin. He said you forgot that last part. It's five wolves and one sheep, but the sheep is well armed.
Look, I live in the state of Florida, for example. Why does federal law apply to me at all when my feet are firmly planted on the ground in Florida?
And that's what we're discussing. So you and I, Angered Jew, we actually agree. We are in agreement. I agree with you. I believe that is a tribal decision to be made by the tribe, and each tribe gets to have its own say. Now, we know, again, according to the Constitution, that when three-quarters of the tribes get together and say, no, this needs to be the law of the land, then the Constitution's amendment, and we do it. But it's got to be that way. There has to be some rights and rules, and there has to be some form of self-rule, and the tribes have to be able to do it. I mean, it goes down to
tell me where lawful people who carry guns have committed crimes in great numbers.
I don't want to get into that. That's a matter for a different subject. Subject matter for a different show. This is where I see all these arguments always ending up, is that people take the general generic idea of should this be a state or a federal law, and they want to drive it down to a very specific issue, and then they want to talk about that particular issue. I want to talk about the overriding.
Out of Washington?
Well, I agree. I don't. I think our federal government already has way too much power.
In a mess already. I think that we need to. I think any law that these chuckleheads in Washington come up with, they ought to get rid of 100 laws off the books. In order to put one law on the books, they ought to get rid of 100 that are already there, because we are top heavy with laws. You can't walk down the street without breaking a law. Remember that old thing about ignorance is no excuse. Well, if I have a lawyer, I don't know what kind of law your father practices, but if I have, say, a lawyer who is a what do you call that? The ones that do OSHA laws and I'm drawing a blank here, but I had a couple clients.
We get the idea. They help people that have been hurt.
Their specialty
on the job
is ecological or. I forget the type of law that it is, but they're not criminal attorneys. Well, they don't know anything much more about the criminal legal system than anybody else does, as it turns out. When you get a lawyer that specializes in something, they don't know about environmental litigation. So an environmental litigator knows very little about criminal law, or knows very little about, patents and trademarks. They are as in the dark as the rest of us. Well, if I'm not a lawyer, and the lawyers can't even know what all the law is, well, how in the hell am I supposed to know what the laws are? So when somebody says, well, ignorance of the law is no excuse, that might have worked back in 1776 when they wrote the laws so that the village idiot could understand the law. And they did write them that way back then. Now the laws are so complex, and when you go to read a law, it's referencing I don't know how many sites from how many different laws, and striking this sentence from that law and striking this sentence from that paragraph and adding the words and or in this place. How in the hell is anybody supposed to know what anything means that comes out of Washington, which is why we get crap like the healthcare thing where it says, well, we've got to pass it to know what's in it. What crap is that? Nobody even knew what was in it. Nobody read it. And even if they read it, they wouldn't have understood it. So you tell me how that's common sense litigation, and you want these chuckleheads who put this stuff on us to be writing laws for everybody down to the last thing in the state? That's nuts.
I totally agree. Thanks, Angry Jew. I appreciate it. I got to move on. We got a bunch of callers in the queue. As always, great to hear from you. And I love his anger and his passion, and I share it. And no, I agree. I think the federal government is way too powerful as it stands right now, way too overreaching, and that's why the amendment process is a beautiful thing, because it doesn't come from the federal government; it has to come from the states. And by the way, Greg, are you okay with that? I did leave the mic open. Are you okay with the states deciding to amend the Constitution, since you're not really for the states having a lot of power?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I don't have any disagreement with the process for amending the Constitution being something that requires a great deal of consensus on the part of Congress and the states itself. I don't think I'd be in such a big hurry as AJ is to give too much credit to the legislators at the state level to be much better geniuses than the people in D.C.
No, I agree. You know,
in fact, I would I'd go so far as to at least only citing the example of my own home state of Pennsylvania. Those are chuckleheads in Harrisburg.
I have to agree. We got a couple of callers in the queue. Let's see what other folks have to say. 641, I'm opening your mic. Your mic is now open. Who we have the pleasure of speaking with?
Hi, it's Bob. Biz Tutor Magic.
Hi, Bob.
On screen. How are you?
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
Bob, remind us where you're calling from.
Pella, Iowa.
Oh, that's right. Okay. How are you this evening, sir?
I'm doing well. I wanted to abruptly get back on topic if I could.
Please do.
Yeah, because the topic for tonight's show is putting the country before the party, an extra emphasis on money and politics issues. So that kind of leads us back to Citizens United and Republican obstruction, in my opinion. Am I wrong there?
We're actually talking about when is it appropriate for states to regulate themselves, and at what point and do people try to circumvent, and we've had a rash of these things lately where people have seemingly either done so or attempted to shortcut the process of creating a national law short of amending the Constitution. And is that right? And that's really what we're talking about, is the right. How much power should the tribes have versus the League of Tribes called the United States of America?
Okay, then I can go there in broad fashion.
Please do.
First of all, I think that the Supremacy Clause basically settles the question, because in the Supremacy Clause you have three supreme laws of the land, and Justice Marshall mentioned this in Marbury versus Madison. You have the Constitution, you have all laws which operate upon the jurisdiction of the United States, and you have treaties. The U.S. Code is equal in weight to the Constitution, as treaties are. Okay? The only proviso relative to the U.S. Code being in that position, and this was decided in McCulloch versus Maryland, is that it has to be within the spirit and letter of the Constitution. As long as the Constitution does not prohibit a law, that law is the supreme law of the land. And that's part of why the Republicans in Congress do not want things like the UN Small Arms Treaty, things like the UN Disability Treaty, because those are treaties, and if they are found to be constitutional, they are equal in weight to the Constitution and thus require a constitutional amendment to get rid of.
Well, okay, but now so there. So now you've opened up a kind of an avenue to something that I find to be right on point, and that is, let's talk for a second about NDAA 2013 and the government's ability to suspend habeas corpus and throw you in Gitmo forever and suspend your right to due process and suspend all of those things you're supposed to be guaranteed in the Constitution, right? And is that okay? Or should somebody? I mean, the New York court that heard the case struck it down in an hour. Said no, you can't do that. And then Obama's lawyers went in and argued at the appellate level and got a temporary stay of that order, and a permanent stay was eventually received, saying yeah, it's okay to do that.
Right, and the problem with that is you're dealing in foreign affairs. And the court tends to see anything that is dealing with other nations first as a presidential core function. Okay.
So I as a citizen can't interact with another nation, otherwise I'm usurping the powers of the presidency?
No,
you lost
that's
me there.
That's not entirely the case. But it is in most cases. I mean, we have diplomats for a reason, okay? And I think if, say, Ted Cruz went over to Syria or went to Israel and worked a deal by which Israel would attack Syria to strengthen itself, and committed U.S. support in Congress to that end, bypassing the president entirely, you would hear a screech from the left that would reach from Chino, California to Augusta, Maine.
I don't doubt that for a second. But I think one of the biggest I got a couple other callers in queue, so I'm gonna put you on hold here for a second. And if anybody who's gotten put on hold, if you put one on your phone, it will bring your hand down on my little hands I got on my little board, and then you can hit one again, and it'll bring your hand up, and we can get you back in the conversation. But I do want to want to get everybody who's been on hold, and we've got people who've been on hold for a while. So if you Bob, if you want to get back on, you know, again, hit one and then hit one again. And now that I was saying that, I'm going to totally forget what I was going to say about what you were saying. And I'm going to blame it on the jet lag, and I'm going to go to the next caller, and maybe somebody can remind me exactly what it was that Bob was saying so that I can make the point I wanted to make to Bob. I know what I was going to say. But I'm going to open this mic, 404, because I know this is the perfect person to bring this up in front of. So, 404, your microphone is open. Tell everybody who we have the pleasure of speaking with.
Robert Rodrigo. Good evening, everybody. How's everybody?
Of course. And this is Robert Rodrigo. If you don't know, you should know, because he's graciously filled in for me. I tried desperately to be awake in Australia so I could listen to the show. I think I got on into the chat room for about 2 seconds, but I couldn't get the feed. So, but I'm sure it was wonderfully fantastic. So,
I appreciated the invite. You're very welcome, and that was nice. Yeah. And I'm glad to have you back. I'm pulling my hair out a little bit. Got to tell you. Okay.
Well, I want to ask you something specifically. Unless you have something you specifically want to comment.
I got some things to say about the discussion, and I need to clarify some things there's a little bit of misinformation going around. But go on. You ask your question first.
All right. Please. So, if you can do that in a couple of minutes, but here's the question I wanted to ask you specifically. I think one of the ways that people use to shortcut the legislative process, as described in the Constitution, and to create national laws, is through executive order. And I'm betting that you can quote a chapter and verse on executive orders that have specifically been made that absolutely circumvent the Constitution and create in and of themselves laws without any legislative process.
Well, I don't think it's necessary to even go there, because the legislative process has actually rewarded the executive lobby to expand executive power that is anti-constitutional as well. Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's been a number. For example, back in the Great Depression, there was some executive orders involving banking, for example. Please don't ask me the specifics, so I have to go back and look at it, because I like to be accurate. But I can tell you that it happened. The Patriot Act, which was a legislative act, of course, what the Patriot Act did is it expanded the power of the executive specifically. By removing due process, it eliminated the court process that the executive has to use in order to gain the access to the information that the three laws that they were talking about in the Patriot Act governed. So what's interesting, for example, about the NSA situation is they talk about the NSA situation as some executive act, when actually this president is using the FISA law, not the Patriot Act, in order to gain the access that he's gaining. And President Bush did not even use the FISA court because he was granted that, because all presidents were granted that power by the legislature. They expanded the executive. And the executive has lobbied for that forever. One of the big battles in our country has been between the three branches wanting to assert itself greater. In my view, what's going on here, what we are faced with, is that the three branches are now working in concert together on many issues. But just a couple of points about what's been being said here. First of all, the Supremacy Clause does not say what that gentleman said. The Supremacy Clause says that the United States Constitution is, in fact, the law of the land. Everything else must comply with the United States Constitution. It does not run roughshod over the states. It does not accept treaties as our law. The reason that the Small Arms Treaty is a fantasy is because the Small Arms Treaty does not, in fact, allow the United Nations to come in and confiscate our guns, because that would be against the Constitution. That is complete falsehood. It does not do that at all. The Supremacy Clause is what it does. It establishes the United States Constitution as a law of the land, and the United States Supreme Court settled that question in 1933. Now, the other issue you mentioned was about the NDAA, for example. The appellate court did not issue a ruling on the merits of the NDAA. What the appellate court did was use the same argument that the Supreme Court did on the California same-sex marriage state amendment, and that it stated that the people who did the lawsuit lacked standing under Article 3 to bring the suit. It never addressed the merits that the district court raised. It vacated the order based upon lack of standing. So while it was a horrible ruling, it still never struck down the actual decision that the court made based upon the merits. That's a big distinction. It's also a big distinction on the tactics that are used to go to the next level. And my final point, to go on point to this show, is you guys are talking about the Tenth Amendment. Wonderful, yes. The Tenth Amendment absolutely gives the states the ability to govern themselves. But there's a balance between what, for example, the Angry Jew, which is wonderful to hear him. I haven't talked with him since Don Manning's show, and you, and what Greg is saying. It's in the middle, gentlemen, because four amendments later answers the question unequivocally. It's not about national laws. It's about everybody having to be required to create laws that conform to the rights that we have protected in the Constitution. That's what the 14th Amendment is all about. The states, of course, ratified that, made it the amendment, approved it, and accepted the fact that when they create laws, and I'm not giving you an opinion about the standing ground law or whatever, but when they create laws, they must also have the same protections that are afforded throughout the Bill of Rights. That's what that means. So the amendment process itself already took care of this discussion completely. Now, if you're going to get into the micromanaging of different laws, that's a whole other subject. But if the laws that the states create, as they withstand the muster of the balance, if the balance is real, which right now I don't think we have a real balance, but if the balance is real, if it withstands the muster, because all laws must be written to protect the individual, regardless of the voting process. And the 14th Amendment took care of this argument, in my view.
I'm trying to follow you, and I think I did mostly. So interesting enough. So it's there seems to be things within the Constitution that are a little bit come into conflict, and then it's a question of which applies. And I have one of these one of the previous callers was asking you to if you could read the supremacy clause. I don't know if you have that at hand. I've been actually trying to look.
I have it in hand. I keep a constitution in my pocket.
Beauty.
So let me read it to you.
All right.
Hang on. The supremacy
and,
clause.
Yeah, and I just while you're looking that up, 518, we're coming to you right away next. And then it looks like we have a Skype caller.
Article 6 of the United States Constitution. This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in... I'm sorry, I got to set up my... I can't see. Okay, here we go. This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made, or which shall be made, under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. So in 1933, and I guess I need to look it up so I can give you the exact citation. But in 1933, this issue was settled by the Supreme Court as far as interpretation goes, and in our society, they're the ones that are supposed to interpret what all this wonderful stuff means. So, and, you know, whether you agree with it or not, that's the government that we have. So, it was actually discussing treaties, actually. And I'll just give me one second. I talked about it on the show before, but I don't remember the exact name.
That's all good and well. And you know, treaties that's a whole nother issue, especially when it comes to trade treaties. And whether those things really are those things proper and a proper execution of the powers of treaties when we do things like NAFTA, or should those things be going through a more scrutinized process? There's a lot of people that don't care for trade treaties.
And a lot of it, one of the cases, for example, in Pennsylvania versus Nelson, the Supreme Court struck down the Pennsylvania Sedition Act. This is in honor of Greg, and of course my son is born in Pennsylvania, which made advocating the forceful overthrow of the federal government a crime under Pennsylvania state law. The Supreme Court held that when federal interest in an area of law is sufficiently dominant, federal law must be assumed to preclude enforcement of state laws of the same subject. For example, that's just a quick one. In Cooper v. Aaron, 1958, the Supreme Court rejected attempts by the state of Arkansas to nullify the court's school desegregation decision of Brown. In Edgar versus MIT Corp. in 1982, the Supreme Court ruled the state statute is void to the extent that it actually conflicts with a valid federal statute. This would support the gentleman when he mentioned the statutes earlier, for the gentleman from Iowa, Bob, I believe his name is. It is not a black and white issue, and I'm going to find this treaty here thing here for you. But I mean, the first time this thing was decided was in 1796, you know, and the supremacy clause has struck down state statutes a lot, and that is even before the 14th Amendment, and the key is whether or not these state laws violate the rights that are enumerated throughout the Bill of Rights. It's a very important distinction. And that's what the 14th Amendment is all about.
Right. Okay. Hang on the line. I'm going to leave you and Greg open. I want to get to 518, who's been patiently holding for the last 40 minutes. Is this Joe?
Dan, welcome back. Joe Pomponi off in Albany.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Got a lively and technical show tonight.
It is. Well, it is. We got...
My business.
We've got all the passionate people. We got Bobby who chimes in with the. He's our good. You know what? I anoint you our show historian. you're our show historian, Bobby. You're the best.
Right.
And great. Okay. He denies the title. Okay. Joe,
it's a tough crowd. That's all I can say.
All right, Joe. What do you have to say about all of this this silliness of state rule versus federal?
Let me just jump back to when you started, because that one kind of got me a little bit. I really don't see a right, left, a conservative, progressive. What I see is a good possibility for people to come together and form ideas that will benefit all of the citizens of a country, okay? What I see being played out is, pardon my expression, a 1% at the top manipulating both sides, pitting one against the other. And while we're not looking, things like the GMO exemption from prosecution gets passed, gun laws beyond prosecution get passed, the environment gets let down. They get exempted. They can drill all the oil wells they want. While we argue about states' rights, not that states' rights aren't important, to get to that, I don't like the decision that came down in Florida. I didn't follow the trial, okay? My issue started long before that, and it is with the Sandra Brown laws. Now, I accept the court's rule. I could expound on how that case was mishandled forever. But it is the ruling of the court. I will live with it, okay? As far as a state's rights, if a state wants to have a law that theoretically can be used by someone to take another life, so he can go before a desk sergeant in a police station and then get released, if they are in that type of environment with that type of government, okay, in all fairness, it's really none of my business. It won't happen where I live. You take a life here, and CSI is going to be on the scene. You're going to be at the police station. All the evidence is going to be gathered. You're going to go for a hearing, and you'll get acquitted if you're innocent. Okay? The case won't even, it'll be dismissed. It won't even go to trial. Okay? If people feel that is the wrong way to do it and they're in a state that wants to do that, I mean, what can I say? Now, I'll abide by this. If you can get and amend the Constitution, I totally agree with it. I think there should be better laws governing firearms, but if, in effect, the states have a right to do that and people want to live in that kind of state under those conditions, if they feel they have to be able to blow somebody away, if their lives are threatened that way on a daily basis, let them go. I mean, it sounds cruel. I don't feel it should be that way. But, the only problem I have, if I want to go to Florida, I'm not a person that owns a handgun. I own a rifle. I'm not going to travel with it. So if I'm going to an environment like this, at least offer me the opportunity to rent a weapon while I'm there. So if, I'm in that kind of environment, I have the ability to defend myself.
Ooh, you may just hit on the brilliant business of the next century. Rent a weapon.
Put a sign up, this is a stand your ground state, and bear that in mind while visiting. I think the state might, kind of look at their laws a little differently, but it's their decision. This is where
that's hilarious. I see that. Welcome to Texas. You know, don't litter. Please respect our highways and our environment. Keep them clean. Don't feed the animals, and don't forget your gun. Now, I say that. Now, please, Texans, don't get mad at me. It's your reputation. It's not my fault. The first time I ever went to Texas on business, I was told, and again, good for angry Jew, I'm not a lawyer, and don't believe me if you don't want to, but I was told that you actually could have open alcohol in a vehicle and firearms in that same vehicle. Now I went, oh, there's a great combination. So forever will that stay in my heart, Texas.
You can pack a weapon in a bar. You can go to school with guns. And if that's the kind of environment they live in, sounds like to me like something I watched when I was a kid, you know, the cowboys in the West. If that's the environment they live under, I don't know why anybody would want to have businesses there.
That's the greatest example, right? So go back in the day. Forget the society live in. Back in the day, you were out east. The Industrial Revolution was in full swing. You had cities and restaurants and, you know, roads and these, you know, whatever else you had. And then there was the Wild West. Well, the law in the Wild West was much different than the law it was in New York. So if you want to go to the Wild West, you go to the Wild West, but you know. Right? And to me, it's almost the same thing as visiting another country. If you go into another country and they have specific customs that are different than yours, should you have the right to just act like an American and offend the crap out of them and not expect some kind of retaliation? Well, I'll tell you the answer to the question. Ask the kid who got caned in Singapore. No. The answer is no. You've got to be aware of it, and you've got to be respectful of it. And if you don't, you've got to be willing to bear the consequences. So to me, that it's that simple. And I'm sorry if laws are very complex and people can't understand them. And I'm sorry if there's 50 different states and you got to know all the there just has to be some decisions left to the tribe. There just have to be. I remember when I was a kid. Let me give you another example. And I will ask the next caller about it when we go on. But let me give you another example. I remember when the movie's rating system came out, and my father, again, the lawyer, not me, my father told me there was something in Illinois called home rule, and that was any city, municipality that had 10,000 or more people had the right to decide whether or not what the age restrictions were for going to see specific movies, right? 18 or under for this, 21 or over for that, blah, blah, blah. They got down to the point where there was power passed down to a municipality. The tribe speaks. No, you have to be 21 to see an X-rated movie. Or it's drinking laws. It's still the same. There's no national drinking law, right? I grew up in Illinois, but right near the Wisconsin border. It was 18 to drink in Wisconsin, 21 to drink in Illinois. Guess where I spent a bunch of weekends?
Yep.
Is that okay? I don't know. Greg would probably say, maybe sanely so, you're encouraging people to drive 40 miles over state lines, get drunk, and then drive home. You know, and that's probably a bad thing. So maybe that's something we need to look at. And it's been brought up before, the idea of a national age for alcohol consumption. Maybe that's worth looking at.
Let me chime in real quick. You're in Oregon, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I saw a piece online about cigarettes and a state tax boosting the price of them, but you could cross the border, I believe, to Idaho to beat the tax, and the person was commenting that all they'll do is lose money. Well, that might be the case. Except as I remember it, I started smoking at 10, okay? I don't think you're going to get many 10 to 18-year-olds driving across the border. So, you know, in effect, it's a punitive tax, true, but the children are the ones that won't be able to get their hands on cigarettes because it'll price them out of the market, hopefully. But,
well, that's very possible, of course, with the price of gas going up. I talked earlier on the show how there's no state income tax in Washington state, but in Oregon there's no sales tax, so people started living on border towns in Washington, not paying any state income tax, but then they would come and they would spend all their money in Oregon where there's no sales tax. So, yeah, again, can there be border abuses? Absolutely. Can somebody fire a gun from – I remember this years ago. They fired a gun from Council Bluffs, Iowa – or no, from a range in Omaha into Council Bluffs, Iowa across the border and, like, hit somebody. I mean, yeah, is that possible? Sure. Are they still liable? Of course. But it again, it just seems to me that I'm with you on the we've got to let certain things be decided at that level. I'm going to go to a Skype caller who is at all ones. Who do we have the pleasure of speaking with?
Not the one angry Jew.
Not the one angry Jew. All you had to do was put your hand down and bring it back up. Okay,
well,
not one angry.
Now I'm in the kitchen making some vegetables. I have a question.
Oh, okay.
Because I heard a couple things that bothered me. Who was it that was quoting the supremacy clause?
That would be Mr. Rodrigo, whose mic is open.
Okay. Let me ask you a question because I think it'll establish where we're at. Does this First Amendment or the Second Amendment of the Constitution, let's just take the Second Amendment. Does the Second Amendment give me the right to bear arms?
Last time I checked, yes.
It does. So I want you to be very careful and listen to my words. Does the Second Amendment give me the right to bear
Actually,
arms?
Actually, it protects your right to bear
Thank
arms.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so when I heard you say that the states are given the right under the federal constitution, how can the created give a right to the creator?
You need to be a little bit more specific because I didn't say that the states – what I said was that the states ratified the 14th Amendment. And what
yes,
that
well,
meant,
I haven't gotten to the 14th Amendment yet. But what I'm saying to you is no matter what is in the federal constitution, it exists because of the state constitutions. It exists because of the people via their legislators, their representatives, who
how do you figure
created
that?
The federal
How do you figure that? How do you figure that?
How did the federal constitution come into being?
It was the 13 colonies
that created it, right?
It was created by the representatives, yes.
Mm-hmm. About the 13 colonies.
That's correct.
Okay. So how does the created give permission to the creator?
Because it's what the created, the creators wrote in it. What must be remembered here is that the document, words need to be used literally.
Of course they do. I wholeheartedly agree. And we're going to get into that in the 14th Amendment in just a second. But I've heard you say more than a few times.
The creators wrote the Constitution. They wrote
it.
Okay, so that's your answer.
Can the federal constitution exist without the states?
It doesn't matter. They wrote it that way. It doesn't matter.
They also wrote in the 10th Amendment that says no matter if we didn't tell you could do something, you couldn't do it. But I heard something different.
No, that's the 9th Amendment.
No, that's the 10th Amendment.
The 10th Amendment didn't give you permission.
No, it doesn't. See, that's where I have a problem.
Hold on, guys. One at a time.
The states told the federal government, hey, federal government, you will not do what is not written in this document. That's the 10th Amendment. That was a...
And then the states wrote the 14th Amendment.
And that is a problem, because the 14th Amendment is an amendment that says I'm not a citizen with rights. I'm a citizen with privileges and immunities. Why don't you read the 14th Amendment? You have it handy. Why don't you read the first two sentences of the 14th Amendment?
I'll read it out loud. First,
please.
I'll read the 10th.
Okay.
The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution not nor prohibited by and to the states are reserved to the states. The 14th Amendment, all persons, God, my glasses are just not working right. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's 14. And of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws.
Okay, can you read the sentence before that once again, please, the one that referenced privileges and immunity?
No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States.
Okay. What happened to my rights? I thought I had rights.
It's in the next two sentences. It refers to life, liberty, or property, and equal protection of the law. Your rights in the Constitution are that which is protected, not which is given. The rights are not given; they're protected.
That's right. But in the 14th Amendment, it doesn't discuss rights; it discusses privileges and immunities. No state shall abridge
life, liberty, and property.
It's
actually the same sentence. It's a prepositional phrase.
All right, guys.
Hold on.
Time out. I'm going to start muting people. All right. What I'd like to do is, AJ, can you kind of tell me where you're going? I see you're leading us down somewhere, but just for let's try to see if we can shortcut this because we're coming near the end of the show.
I will tell you exactly where I'm going. If you read the colloquy that was debated in the House and the Senate over the 14th Amendment, I have read it. You will find that these fine senators and congressmen were discussing how to give standing to the now freed slaves. They didn't want, and nor did they ever intend, that everybody in the United States to be a 14th Amendment citizen. They intended it as a substandard class of citizenship for the now freed slaves, which we now all call ourselves United States citizens, and we are now a substandard citizen because we no longer have rights. We have privileges and immunities, thank you, to the 14th Amendment. That's where I'm going.
Mr. Rodrigo, counterpoint, or agree?
I disagree. That I know of the argument that he's talking about. I disagree that it doesn't discuss rights because it specifically mentions life, liberty, and property, which are the rights that are...
No, you're interpreting that. You're interpreting it to mean that. It doesn't say rights. Where are the words rights in the 14th Amendment?
It doesn't say rights. It says life, liberty, and property. You can't lose life, liberty,
and
property.
It says privileges and immunities in the sentence prior to that. It doesn't say rights. So you agree with me that the word rights is not in the 14th Amendment, right?
That is correct. I agree with you.
Okay, so that if it's not there,
right. But
okay.
I do. But
so
if I
consider myself,
I disagree with you that life, liberty, and property
I know you do.
Are not rights. They are rights.
Well, I disagree, and I disagree with you. But if I am a 14th Amendment subject citizen, I have privileges and immunities. Well, I'll tell you what. I would like to offer you a huge bag full of privileges and immunities. Or you could choose from door number 2, which has a few rights in it. Which one do you want to choose?
I'll take
because,
the Constitution of Britain. That's how
privileges and immunities are those given by Congress. They can be given by Congress. They can be taken away. You can't take away my rights per the Constitution, what the Constitution protects. But if I call myself a 14th Amendment subject citizen, I've now admitted that I have privileges and immunities. I no longer have rights. And the privileges and immunities that you may think are good things, Congress can take away at any time. Do you disagree with that?
No, I don't.
But that's always
been
true.
So then I'll ask you again.
But that's always been true.
Immunities, or you want rights? You want a bag full of privileges and immunities, or would you like some rights?
AJ, hold on a second, because that we discussed this three or four shows ago. I did this, and I led with that whole Carlin piece about you don't have rights. That's all you have is privileges, and they can be taken away from you anytime the government sees fit. Just like
I'm
they
sorry,
have been with NDAA, and just like they did, you know, the way his punchline to the whole joke is, and if you don't believe me, Google 1942 Japanese Americans in the Northeast.
That would be the example that I would give, or the Italians that they threw into concentration camps.
Yeah, and we just let it happen. That's the scary thing, is we just let it happen. And that's been my objection to this whole process the whole time. We constantly see these people that skirt the laws, that skirt the processes, that just go, and it's always, you know, not always, but, you know, like the whole Patriot Act. It was done because we were angry, and they got us all, you know, they've got us all our pitchforks out and our torches, and we're, oh, let's go kill the monster. And yeah, hey, if we need to suspend our privileges or our rights because we, you know, in order to kill the monster, then damn it, let's do it. And we do
it. Well,
it sounds
to me like we agree, doesn't it?
Of course we do. Whether it's codified in law specifically, I mean, again, you know, I'm no constitutional scholar, and you know, you two guys know way more about the stuff than I do. But again, the problem is it's open to interpretation, which is why we have courts, right? And then that brings us to a whole other slippery slope.
How much interpretation is there when you don't hear the word rights, but you hear the words privileges and immunities, and the gentleman wants to tell me that he can interpret the other one to mean, well, those are your rights. You know, that's what that means.
I hear what you're saying. I appreciate your comments, as always. And we have another caller. Oh, nope, 641, you do not have your hand up. I wanted to go back to Biz. I want to open your mic here in a second because you had a couple of things to say on the subject before we shut down for the evening. So you wanted to offer some more reflection on the 14th Amendment and all the other good constitutional talk. Bob? Hello, Bob? Yeah, okay, we don't have Bob. All right. Greg, you still there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Oh, okay, good. I thought sometimes when I talk and I got people's mics open and I don't hear anything back, I worry that I've been dropped from the show, which, I don't know, may make it more interesting. But, hey, we've had a heck of a night tonight, haven't we?
Yes, it has. It's been engaging, thought provoking, controversial, all the right ingredients for an exciting show.
And guess what? We've got 2 hours. I know we're scheduled for 90 minutes, but we've always got 2 hours of studio time. And 641 just did raise their hand. So 641, I'm going to open your mic. Who do we have the pleasure of speaking with?
It's Bob.
Hey, it's Bob. Okay. I got you in the wrong place. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, I wanted to raise thorough disagreement with the caller who says we only have privileges and immunities. Okay? If the 14th amends the previous 13 amendments collectively, okay? Counterpoints directly found in the 15th and the 19th amendment, where it specifically refers to the right to vote.
Okay.
Okay, so Congress cannot, or the states cannot have meant that people only have privileges and immunities, and if they did, that was directly contradicted by the use of the word right in the 15th Amendment, the amendment that immediately followed the 14th. And if that is the case, privileges and immunities are created statutorily, but the Constitution guarantees rights. Now, can those be taken away by a tyrannical government by force? Yeah. Korematsu versus United States, which is the landmark case on Japanese internment, does in fact prove that. Okay? But we're talking about tyranny, not the usual course and scope of events in the United States.
But are we? I mean, I used to think that, but 9/11 brought out another one of those things. And as far as I'm concerned, the federal government used that as a way to grab power. They used it as a way to declare and wage what most people, I think, believe was an unjust war in Iraq. They used it to expand the presidential powers, right? So, I mean, at what point do you think, okay, these people in Washington they're looking out for us, versus at what point do you just think these people are there looking out for them and they're only there to expand their own power bases and do the bidding of their rich donors? You know, I'd love to believe that our government is full with altruistic people, but I'm not that stupid.
Oh, we know better than that. Good Lord. However, as far as the constitutional points go, we do have rights, and they are enforceable in courts. I mean, every single day. Okay.
I totally agree with you. And you know what? I wish they would have never talked about rights after they wrote.
If we don't have rights, that makes Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission a nonentity.
Because?
Because that case is all about the right to free expression through speech and the press and paying for that right.
Okay.
Okay, paying for the distribution of the exercise of that right.
Well, right. So here's the weird thing, right? So we start out with this first document, right? July 4, 1776, that claims we have inalienable rights, right? Three of them.
To life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Yeah.
Right. Then somebody in the federal government realizes, you know what? That's way too broad. We can't give these bozos all that power. No, that's not a good thing. we need to really in the end control them, right? So we've got to put a lid on. And even you talk about the First Amendment, right? There's even limitations on that, right? You cannot go into a crowded movie theater and yell fire.
Yes, you can. If the theater is in fact on fire.
But if it's not, you can't.
You are not allowed to falsely shout fire in a crowded theater, and that comes, I believe, from Schenck versus the United States.
And the school can regulate dress requirements. And they can stop you from walking around and putting up Nazi hate propaganda there are limits, right? The problem is, again, there's your slippery slope. As soon as you start encroaching on those limits.
I was at UCLA one day and asked a guy to take off his swastika earrings. He turned to me and he said, "No, I will not." He says, I have the First Amendment right to wear these earrings. They are a form of symbolic speech." And I couldn't argue against him. I couldn't.
What is it? Locus parentis. When you're on campus, you give the campus the authority. You sign away your rights, and you give the campus the authority that you would have that your parents have. Right? Isn't that what it is? Locus parentis.
I
ran into that a couple of times as well.
However, there was a case called Des Moines School District versus Tinker, which was decided right here in Iowa, where the court expressly held students do not shed their rights at the schoolhouse door. okay? They are subject to locus parentis authority, but they do not shed their rights. They are merely regulable.
Well, and again, and then now we're back to what we were talking about before. If something can be taken away from you, is it really a right? No, it's a privilege.
We're right
back to that same point. But
right.
No, listen.
But when they're under 21, they haven't reached the age of majority, and the framers never considered giving full rights to children. I mean, that would never have occurred to them. Back in those days, you were seen but not heard if you were a child.
Right.
If you were heard, you were likely to end up on the wrong end of the hickory switch.
Oh, corporal punishment. Oh, boy, that's another slippery slope we can't go down, or we're not allowed to anymore, right?
Yeah.
All right, Bob. Thanks very much for your comments. Tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to do something Egberto Willis like on the queue. That is, my wife just walked in the door, and she's going to want to eat dinner soon. So I'm going to actually do something Egberto like. I'm going to open up everybody's microphone, and I'm going to give everybody exactly 2 minutes to make a final statement, if you care to. 2 minutes, and then we'll do like they do in the debates. We'll turn off the mic at 2 minutes. So I'm going to start with 1AJ. And we're going to work backwards to Greg, who was our first caller, and we're going to give him the final word before I get the final word. So, Mr. Angry Jew, your mic is open. You have two minutes, sir. You're on the clock.
That's a fantastic choice. The guy who just said that you can exercise your rights in court. Well, I don't know if anybody followed the case of the guy who was chalking the sidewalks in front of Bank of America. They told him specifically, the judge said that he could not bring up the First Amendment as a defense in his courtroom. So it's either you can't have it both ways. You can either bring it up or you can't bring it up. If you can't bring it up, then I say somebody is regulating your rights. And I agree with what you just said, which is if somebody can modify or take them away, then they're not rights. They're privileges and immunities. It goes back to the 14th Amendment. That's exactly what it says. It does what it says. And if you want to admit that you're a United States citizen, I do not consider myself to be a United States citizen. I consider myself to be a citizen of the state with all my rights intact and an inhabitant upon the land, not a 14th Amendment subject citizen. And I suggest that you all go read the colloquy from the 14th Amendment to find out that these fine gentlemen had no intention of affording the newly freed slaves rights equal to their own. It was not there. They didn't want to do it. And this is what they came up with. But they never intended. And they say it right in the colloquy. And if you go look at Bouvier's dictionary or Ballantyne's and look up the definitions of what is a person, well, they break it down to what is a white person and what is not a white person. That's what they
have in mind.
This 14th Amendment.
Whoops. Sorry, we got to the 2 minutes, AJ. I apologize, but we've got to respect the rules. But you know what? You've just given me another homework assignment, so I'm going to definitely go check that out. 518, we're opening you up. Joe Poponio, 2 minutes. You're on the clock.
Okay, Dan. Great show. I got to admit, I learned a lot. Good constitutional lessons here. I just comment on the fact that if this were 1790, I'm quite sure the laws would be applied to people that understand them at that time. We're in the 21st century. 200 years later, laws have a way of changing and being amended, and they've done so with the consensus of the population. So, I mean, if you want to abolish all laws and go back to that time period, you won't be able to regulate traffic, you won't have health laws, you won't have any protections. I don't know where you can go from there. Otherwise, it was a great show.
All right, Joe, I appreciate your sentiments and your participation as always. Joe Poponio. 305, opening you up. Earlier I thought this was Bob, but I guess this wasn't Bob. 305, your mic's open. Forgive my jet laggedness. Okay, I think that was Bob twice. Okay, so we'll close that up and we'll go to Greg, whose mic has always been open. But I think he self mutes. I think that's why we hear that beep. So, Greg, 2 minutes, you're on the clock. If you're there.
Can you hear me?
Yep, hear you now.
Okay, all right, good. Yeah, I enjoyed this show quite a bit. It's a very lively, spirited discussion. I have some feelings that I think that are similar to Joe's, and that is that any society that wants to continue to progress, and I think the word progress is a good word, needs to accept the proposition that a literal interpretation of a document written over 200 years ago is not the way to move forward. It's at best the way to stand still, and I'm not a fan of doing that. I consider myself to be a citizen of the United States first, as well as a citizen of the state of Pennsylvania. But when I go overseas and somebody says, where are you from? I don't say Pennsylvania. I say the United States. And I think that's an important proposition that Americans, and especially those who are vehement states' rights advocates like our friend AJ, might want to consider in thinking about the best way forward for this country. Thank you.
Okay. There you go. If elected, Greg will. No, I'm just kidding you, Greg. Greg Rusick. It's a beautiful thing. Okay, so I'm going to have to hold myself to 2 minutes on the clock. So now I'm on the clock. So here's what we've learned today. No, I can't possibly sum that up in 2 minutes. It's been a great show. I'm just going to do this. I'm going to finish with this. There's a system in place. It's called amending the Constitution. We need to allow people to have self-rule. We need to allow different tribes to have different rules. And I especially believe this, that we could solve so many of our problems and we could put so many issues to bed, these social divisive issues, if we just say accept that things like gun control, things like same-sex marriage, all of these social issues, I think if we could just say, hey, you know what, we're going to push these down to the states and let each tribe make their own rules on marriage, make their own rules on whether they can carry weapons or not, make their own rules, and again, publish them, make sure that everybody knows them, you know, then I think we could get on to the bigger problems we have in this country. And you know what, my number one thing is, let's get people back to work, right? Let's get people back to work. And that's where I believe that the progressive agenda has to come in, has to take over. I never was a progressive, but after 33 years of failed trickle-down economics, I am. And I think that has to be on a national basis. But you know what? I'm waiting for the state that does it first. Where's the state that's going to stand up and say, we're going to raise taxes, and we're going to put together a jobs program, and we're going to put people to work? Somebody needs to lead the way, right? So maybe then everybody else will get on the bandwagon. But that's it. So there's my 2 minutes. I appreciate everybody's listening. It was a phenomenal show. And I'm also going to go on a limb, and I'm just going to finish with this. I think we have the most intelligent callers of any coffee party show there is. So I'm going to challenge Egberto Willis, who does Politics Done Right on Saturday morning, 10 a.m. Yeah, 10 a.m. Pacific time, 1 p.m. in the East Coast time. I'm going to challenge the Middle Ground, Eric Beiler and Michael Charney, who are on every Tuesday night starting at 5 a.m. on or 5 p.m. Pacific time, and 8 a.m. Here I go again. Sorry again, jet lag. 8 p.m. on the East Coast time, and I'm going to challenge Janine Loudon and Debbie Lynn Molyneux, who do Lunch with Loudon at noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. East Coast time. And I'm going to challenge you guys and say, I've got the most intelligent group of callers, and that's what makes this a great show. So thank you all, and have a wonderful evening.